The Dharma, incomparably profound and exquisite, is rarely met with even in hundreds of thousands of millions of kalpas. We now can see it, hear it, accept and hold it. May we realize the true mind of the Tathagata. Today is day 3 of this 7-day sesshin, the first sesshin in January 2016 at Mountain Gate in northern New Mexico, and we are in the midst of a snowstorm and have had some adventures this morning. On heading up for breakfast, we discovered that there was no heat and no propane to make any heat. And a call to the propane folks, the emergency number actually got us to a fake site wanting us to give information for a chance to win a Caribbean cruise for two. But when we finally were able to get in touch with the propane company, we got the headquarters in a different state because in New Mexico it still was too early for the propane, the local office, to be open. And so once we were able to contact the local office, they were not sure they could actually get a truck out here because of the snow and the conditions of the road. We have a fair amount of snow here at the moment, and it has continued to snow all day. And apparently the storm is not finished, and another one is due in on Monday. And this is Friday. This is winter in the mountains of New Mexico. So we were able, through the kindness of our neighbors, to borrow an electric heater that helped prevent the pipes from breaking in the Kanondo. And after lunch, thankfully, Larry came from the propane company and cheerfully delivered our propane, filled the tank again, and came in and relit the pilot lights on the wall heater and checked our stove, which turns out is perhaps the oven is maybe on its last legs, which is rather unfortunate because we're not sure when we will be able to buy a new stove. But that's to be taken care of another time. We have no end to excitement in this part of the country, in this relatively remote area. Mountain Gate is in a tiny little village, 140 families, a historic Spanish settlement. In the era when Santa Fe was being attacked by marauding Native Americans, generally speaking, the Plains Indians, but not normally the local Pueblos, they established what were outlying villages around the area to sort of take the hit first. And there are some interesting stories about that, including in the next village over, Tuchas, which translates in Spanish to trout, is perched on the edge of the mountain and was overrun by Native Americans at one point, and the settlers fled, and the Native Americans went into their houses and were lighting fires inside, of course for warmth, not to burn the houses down. And the settlers snuck back at night and dropped chili peppers down the chimneys to an ancient version of pepper spray, I guess, and it chased the marauding natives out, and they got their houses back. The attacks by Native Americans were recent enough that another member of our village, who mentioned to me at one point that he bought his aunt's house, it still had the narrow slit windows in it, which were built that way so that they could put a rifle out and not get an arrow in. Nowadays, there's not that kind of a problem. We have other more modern problems like lack of electricity periodically. One memorable Rohatsu Sesshin here at Mountain Gate, when we still had the outhouse, luckily, we got a call from a neighbor saying they were having to shut down the village water supply completely because there was a major leak somewhere and they hadn't been able to track it down. And it had already burnt out two well pumps. So they had no choice but to shut down the well until they found the source of the problem. And so for the rest of Sachin, we had no running water. Well, we didn't have running water here anyway. We had an outside spigot. And we were customized to haul water. And for that, we had 3 5-gallon containers of water in what we call the old kitchen nowadays, a kitchen that had no running water, but it did have a refrigerator and a stove and electricity. And that's where we cooked for a long time. It was a very tiny little thing. We threw it up on a weekend in November as the snow was falling, actually, because the kitchen in the little old travel trailer where I was residing back then was dying, and we needed some place to cook. And that's where we did cook for a long time until we were finally able to purchase the property next door where the Kanondo is, and that's our kitchen and dining area. And it was that building that didn't have a propane source today. At any rate, many people during that Rohatsu Sesshin had the adventure of a first-time experience of using an outhouse in December. If you've ever lived in Japan and in a temple, you've had that experience all the time. But it's a rare one in the United States. And we've had other adventures that were similar as well. But I won't go into them now, because I would like to talk about practice today. We've had a number of things come up during the Sesshin. Yesterday we did 108 recitations of the Enmijuku Kanon-gyo, the 10-verse Kanon Sutra, for Jusen, who was having open heart surgery all day long there. And we had heard about Seki finally dying of her cancer at Sogenji and the funeral and so on. I received photographs of that. By the way, Jusen's surgery was successful, and we are very grateful for that. And then today, the adventures with the lack of propane and the possibility that the pipes would freeze in that building, and they have frozen before. We have had the experience of walking into a lake, really, inside, which is not where you want a lake, particularly not in January. And other adventures. It gives us an opportunity to respond in the moment as conditions need to be responded to jump out of our habit patterns of reactivity, to jump for a moment out of our self-image and simply respond to the moment as it needed to be responded to. We're fortunate if we are free enough in our mind state to be able to do that. And many people are, but some people are not. Over lifetimes, we've developed assumptions about ourselves, assumptions about situations, projections, transference, all kinds of mix-ups, misperceptions, a great deal of misperceptions usually, and they come out of our assumptions about ourselves and of our environment as we are growing up, depending on what experiences we've had. And if we have had negative experiences, then we are guarded and in some cases thrown into a tizzy when something triggers memories of those experiences or seems like it might replicate those experiences. And all of this is fodder for practice. If it is extreme, of course, it's especially beneficial to also work with a professional therapist to help us go into the deeper challenges of our psyche. But there's a fine line between Zen practice and psychotherapy, because Zen practice naturally involves becoming more aware of the stuff of our mind, of our habit patterns, of our assumptions, of our conditioning. And then we need to know how to work with that. And basically, the work of Eugene Gendlin, who developed a way of working with people that he called focusing, is extremely useful in Zen, and actually, it really is Zen practice. It all started out with psychotherapists wondering why it was that some people could go years and years and years and years in therapy and never move off what a good friend of mine calls their stuck place. Whereas other people could open and transform and move on and become more and more free and their best qualities revealed through the therapy. What was the difference? What did that second group do or know or understand that the first group didn't? And when they looked at videos and transcripts of therapy sessions, they quickly discovered that the people that were able to make change in their lives could focus. And this is not an intellectual focus. This is a focus on our bodily experiences. Focus on the felt sense, as Eugene Gendlin calls it. And this is particularly useful in times when we're up against something difficult, whether it's a feeling of being blocked, or whether it's an unpleasant feeling, an unpleasant memory, it doesn't really matter what it is. And it's useful to really to be in the stance of focusing at any time, all the time. It's called mindfulness at its best. And it's a little bit deeper than mindfulness. It goes into a way of experiencing that is a little bit beyond mindfulness, at least as mindfulness is taught in the United States these days. And interestingly enough, Longchenpa, a Tibetan Buddhist teacher, and I think it was the 14th century, somewhere around there, discovered the same thing, or taught the same thing, let's put it that way. This is a what is known as a terma teaching, a teaching that he felt was not possible to grasp yet by people in Tibet. But he left it as a teaching hidden, a hidden teaching, that would one day become manifest when people were ready to be able to understand it and take it and work with it. And he said, and I should memorize this because it's such a useful way of speaking about it, but in essence it's focusing. He says, whatever difficult feeling comes up, whether it's anger or lust or it doesn't matter what it is, in the first moment of its inception, to immediately tune in. Before karma has been created, in other words, before you've acted out, before you've repressed it or before you've acted, tune in and stay present with it until it dissolves. He didn't say it dissolves, but that's what it does when we do stay fully present with it 100%. He said it is freed in its own place and becomes the pleasurable sense. It doesn't have to be gotten rid of. You don't have to stuff it out of your mind. Try not to feel it. By contrary, you want to go into the physical experience, not the ideas about it, not the story around it, because those will just keep you trapped, but the felt sense of it in your body becomes truly liberating. And it doesn't matter what it is. Many, many, many years ago, I was in therapy for some good reasons, and my therapist was trying to encourage me to open up and feel my anger. I didn't feel like I had any anger. I had stuffed it away so well that it was hidden from my perception, although it wasn't hidden from other people's perception, unfortunately, or perhaps fortunately, because finally, I was urged to open to it, and I was quite frightened at the prospect, because the anger that had been expressed to me had been terrifying. And in fact, I thought a number of times that I was literally going to be killed, murdered, as a result of the rage of a person that I was closely related to. And because of that, I was terrified that if I felt my anger, I would act in the same way as that person did. And I did not want to do anything like that to anybody. I did not want to hurt anyone in the whole universe. And I was afraid if they felt the anger that I would act on it. Well, my very skilled therapist brought me into an experience that made me realize that I wouldn't have acted on it. And so I began to dare to open to the sensation. It was very difficult at first because I had been very effective in shutting it down. And it took a lot of awareness, a lot of tuning in, to catch even a flicker of the anger, and then to expand my presence with it. And then I was able to realize what Longchenpa talked about and what Eugene Genlin suggests so strongly and teaches, that it really will, when we tune into, when we feel it completely, there will be a shift and a release and a truly felt release and ease as the feeling dissolves. And from then on, it doesn't have the kind of power over us that it did when it was underground. Of course, it's likely to come up again, but each time it comes up less strongly. And technically, what we're doing is we're reprogramming our brain. We're actually rewiring our circuits to let go of the habituated connections between synapses, so that these reactions don't come up as frequently, and eventually they just don't come up at all if we do our work. And that, you know, of course, anger is a rather major feeling to deal with, but it can also work with other feelings, with grief, with frustration, with feelings of rejection. It doesn't matter what it is, with terror. And this is very useful in our practice, because the practice that we teach here, the extended out-breath called Sosokan in Japanese, is a very grounding practice. And at the same time, like any Zen practice, it will take the lid off and reveal what's hidden in our psyche. And if we've had challenging experiences, the residue of those experiences will come up. And that gives us a chance to work with them or free ourselves from them. And using this practice, the combination of the extended out-breath, which requires focusing, which requires presence, as well as allowing ourselves to be present, fully experiencing the felt sense of any difficult emotions in our body, including feelings of feeling blocked. Because often that's the first sense that comes up when there's something buried underneath. And it's not necessary to know what it is that's buried. We tune in to this feeling of being stale, flat, blocked. The breath only going so far out and no further. Or even having a hard time breathing at all. feelings of choking. There's a lot of ways that something in the past is making its presence known, but yet we're not ready to open to it fully. And through the practice, unless it's a major trauma, we are able to tune in, allow ourselves to experience that felt sense, stay out of the story, this is vital, and over time it can process through and we can be more free of it. And then our practice, our Zen practice, can go deeper because it's often blocked by these things. And as we continue, we may come around again to some more subtle version of whatever that thing is. But now we know how to work with it. Although, of course, we may get dismayed. We thought we'd got it cured or gotten rid of or processed through. And then it can be a disappointment to find that there's a more subtle version of it buried deeper. But this, again, offers a tremendous opportunity for freedom. Because true liberation, among other things, is liberation from our stuff, including this pervasive self-image that needs to be maintained, that gets insulted, that gets endangered, that reacts, that is conditioned, and causes endless suffering. Here and there, some pleasure, but always mixed with pain. Because this is the normal human condition of the conditioned human being. And to do our practice is to little by little begin to see through this conditioning. Faith, doubt, and determination are the three essentials to successful practice. And it's important right now to warn you not to measure yourself. For years, when Kapler-Roshi would recite this during Taisho, he'd say the three essentials of Zen practice are great faith, great doubt, and great determination. And as far as I knew, the only thing I had was great stubbornness, because I knew that there was no way I was going to be free through anything outside of me. That the only way was to walk through the swamp inside as long as it was required until I came out the other side. I thought this dirty little secret that I kept to myself, that I didn't have any faith, that sooner or later the Roshi would see it, kick me out. I was quite frightened of that, actually. And about 20 years later, when I mentioned this to my Dharma brother Bodhin, he laughed, and rightly so. I never would have stuck it out for 20 years, or in the case it is now, more than 40 years, if I hadn't had faith. So don't measure yourself. It's just an exercise in futility. And it will only cause you pain because you'll, based on your conditioning, decide that you're not worthy or that you can't do it, or you may as well go, as Hakoin decided at one point, and learn calligraphy and try to make a living that way. Although I don't know that people can really make a learning doing calligraphy nowadays. But Hakoin himself, the great Zen master Hakoin, fell prey to disappointment, to self-judgment for a while, and then he did come to his senses after a few months and went back to practice, newly inspired, and eventually became a great teacher. So great that all the Rinzai lineages in Japan now come through Hakuin. The others have all died out. So we have this accustomed mindset that we come into practice with. And it colors our outlook, colors our perceptions, particularly our assumptions about ourselves and our assumptions about others, and of course then our assumption about our practice too. And we go through a period of time relatively early in our practice when we long deeply for some acknowledgement that we're doing it right, that we're getting somewhere, that we're on the right path. And this is where faith is so vital. We just have to have faith that if we keep bringing our mind back to the practice, in this case, the extended out breath with the curiosity and openness as to what it might reveal beneath the end of that. And if we stay out of our heads, except when we actually need to be intellectually active, but explore beyond words, that ultimately we will get there. Great doubt comes into play with regard to what brings us to practice. We're not sitting here in this endo because we know all about life. We may think we do on the surface, but there's some part of us that has a question about it. Is this really all there is? Or there's so much violence in the world. How do I escape this? It's like the monk who asked the master, and this is a koan, how do you escape heat and cold? In Japan, in the temples in winter, it is quite cold. A friend of mine has just recently emailed me saying that she'll be going to Japan on a temple tour and wondered what kind of clothes to take. And the first thing I asked her, of course, was what time of the year she'd be going. It can get very, very, very cold in Japan. And there's no heat in many places, including in temples. In January, Harutoshi has two small kerosene stoves brought into the drafty zendo. It was built 300 years ago, more than 300 years ago, renovated since then, and actually they took out the false ceiling and opened up the whole thing up to the inside of the roof, which made all the heat, of course, go up top, which is very nice in the summer, but in the winter it's dreadful. One stove in the zendo proper and one stove in the gaitan, where temporary visitors sit, in order to bring the temperature up to freezing. Chilblains, frostbite, are not uncommon. The years that I lived there, my hands were bleeding every winter. My ears were bleeding every winter. One winter I went to India for the month of February for a conference of Western ordained Buddhist women. And coming from Japan at the beginning of what they call the Daikon, the Great Cold, I got to warm India and chunks of skin fell off my fingers. That's how cold it gets in the winter. In the summer, I've seen huge trees wilt in the heat, over 100 degrees, and incredible moisture. Humidity is unbelievable because it's an island nation. So this monk asking, how do you escape heat and cold? Really, really was concerned. And the master said, you die to the heat and cold. How do you die to the heat and cold? You become so one with it. You don't barricade yourself against it. You feel it immensely, completely, totally, fully. And then there's no one feeling it. It is just in the winter or in the summer. At Sogenji in the summertime, There would be lakes on our cushions, rivers of sweat pouring down our bodies. There was no air conditioning. Heating and cooling, any form of fuel in Japan is quite expensive because almost all of it has to be imported. So, it is our practice too. It was our practice today to eat breakfast before we could bring any more heat into the building. Rather more cold than we were usually accustomed to. The same for mind states on the cushion. The same for mind states off the cushion too. Experiences off the cushion. The more we can become one with whatever is going on, and that means feeling it fully in our body, the essence, the sense of it, the freer we are of the experience. And what that allows then is a capacity to be centered enough that we can respond to the circumstance rather than getting into some reactivity based on our conditioning. And this is so vital in this world that's so full of trauma these days. So there are lessons. Tune in. Don't judge. Keep going. Reach further. And don't leave your practice on the cushion when you leave the zendo. That doesn't mean trying to focus on the out-breath in the middle of trying to do something critical. Then you're dividing your attention, and that's not appropriate. That's not Zen practice. When you're doing something, do it fully. That's Zen practice. But also be aware out and about when your habit patterns are raising their head, and question whether they need to be indulged in. Question whether they are really accurate anymore, valid anymore. And this way you'll be doing 360-degree practice. This long maturation that Tore Enji, who was Hakuin's premier Dharma successor, taught and felt was so, so important. And in our lineage as well, it is vital. Because you can have the most fantastic Kensho on the cushion. And if you can't bring it to life in everything you do and say and think, instead of still acting out in the old habit patterns, then that Kensho has no value whatsoever. Kensho is seeing into the true nature of reality. And if we can see into the true nature of reality, what are we doing hanging out in the cave of our delusion? This is very important. There's a really interesting book that was the teachings of Morinaga Soko Roshi, who was one of the Rinzai masters in Japan. Died of cancer in the 1990s, about 1995 maybe, 95, 96, sometime around then, and left a single Dharma heir. And he was, his story is quite interesting and quite educational, really. It's been translated into English by Belinda Adigwe, who unfortunately is dying of pancreatic cancer now. She remained in Japan, married a Japanese monk who had a family temple, and lived the life of the wife of a family priest. And now in her, I think in her 50s probably, maybe early 60s at the most, she has pancreatic cancer, which is a kind of cancer that is normally not found until it's quite advanced, and from which there is no help if it's that that advanced. The book, the translated book, is called Novice to Master, An Ongoing Lesson in the Extent of My Own Stupidity. And it is Morinaga Soko Roshi's own story, and well worth reading. Like most people, he came to Zen practice through pain, through loss, and initially was quite self-absorbed. But over the years, he was able to train and gradually let go of that self-absorption and become a premier teacher of Rinzai Zen. So, I think I've talked long enough here, and hopefully I've shared some things that will be useful to you in your practice. I thank you for listening, and we'll now stop and recite the four vows.